This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
So when COVID hit, I had to manage two big pharmacies in the middle of town in Dunedin. So that really shifted me.
Hello everyone.
大家好.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamualaikum.
And kia ora.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome back to Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for, and about the multicultural people of Dunedin in New Zealand. Today, we have Lee Tan from Well and Being and also Groom with us today. I'm really excited to get to know her a bit more. Kia ora, Lee.
Good morning. Kia ora.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast. You're on the other side of the mic, which is a bit different to you.
I know, my first time ever, and I don't have to prepare anything. This is so exciting. It's actually quite liberating. As you know, as a podcast host, there's so much background work you have to do, but mm-hmm. I'm just excited to download and to share.
I love how when I asked you if you want to see my notes, you said no.
No.
You know, you just want to be in the moment.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I do, because when my guests will ask, oh, what do you want me to talk about? I'm like, I just prefer free-flowing conversations because then you really get the essence of that person. If something is too prepared, you're just not going to get the true spirit of the conversation.
Mm. And yeah. I'm excited to see where this conversation is going to go
I'm
as
excited
well.
Too. Mm. I haven't had an opportunity to talk that much about myself.
Yay!
It's often about other people. So, yeah.
Let's just give a bit of a rundown on who you are. How would you usually introduce yourself to someone new?
Wow, that's an interesting one, right? It's mm-hmm. like elevator pitch. 30 seconds, talk about yourself. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say that, hi, my name is Lee. I'm a master health coach with a background in pharmacy and environmental and nutritional medicine. I own two businesses in Dunedin. Well and Being, as well as Groom Laser and Skin Clinic. I am married with two adult girls, and my three values are excellence, service, and innovations.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think that's how I would introduce myself.
I've actually never heard anyone with those three values.
Yeah, it's something that took me a while to realize. When I did my mental fitness coaching, and one of the exercises that we had to do is to talk about values, because when you guide someone through their journey of, you know, wanting to be more mentally fit, they need to know their values. Because once you know your values, then you will know what feels aligned with you and what doesn't. And then if you keep remembering, okay, those are my three values, I'm just going to be guided by that all the time. So if I do something that is opposite to my values, I won't feel good.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's good to put that to the front as well so that you're always aware.
Yeah.
I love that you introduce yourself with your values.
Well, I guess it's because I have done quite a few talks to business people and then – my values are individual to me because no one else will share the same values. Well, maybe there'll be someone out there that share the same values as me. But yeah, that's how I would do it.
Are you interested to know my values?
Wow, there's lots and lots of tests you can do online.
Mm.
So try it yourself. Mm. And then you also possibly be quite surprised that it may change along the way. You know, those are my three, if you like, sort of dominant values. Obviously, family is one of my values as well. And you'll find that it will change. But I guess what hasn't changed for me is the service component. When I was young, I grew up in a family business. So I've always seen my parents being of service to others.
Can you tell me about that family business?
Yeah. So I was born in Malaysia and I grew up in a hardware store. So my parents had a hardware business where they sell nails and plywood and hammers to people. So I've always seen my parents work really hard and, you know, deliver goods here and there. So I think service really was drilled into me. And when I did my degree and everything, and because I was able to travel a lot, so I've always wanted to be a flight attendant.
Mm.
So when I was 7 and a half, my parents sent me to school, me and my brother to school in Singapore. So I've always seen the flight attendants on Malaysian Airlines. And I've always thought, oh my gosh, I want to work, you know, in the aeroplane. So then when I finished my pharmacy degree, I became a flight attendant.
I did not know that about you.
Yeah, wow. Well, not a lot of people do.
And I guess with flight attendants, the service part was
exactly.
Very important. Yeah,
yeah, it's all about being of service to others. So again, that wasn't something that I realised till I did my training a few years ago. And it was quite interesting how I became a community pharmacist as well, because again, that is of service to the community. And it's just fascinating, right? And why that feels so natural to be of service to others. And something that I realized recently was I went to a retreat in Australia, and the lady said, if you're stuck in a traffic jam and then you let the car through, do you normally expect the other person to wave back and say thank you? And I thought about it. I'm like, actually, most of the time I do, because if they don't, I'll be like, oh, God, you know, how rude or whatever.
Yeah.
And then she was like, if you are truly in service to others, you should expect nothing back. And that dropped like a ton of bricks.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, I've been looking at service all wrong. So that's taken me nearly 50-odd years to realize that. Yeah.
That's a very good point. And it just changes your mindset for anything, not just being stuck in a traffic jam, you know?
Exactly. Mm. It's like when I'm in business now, it's been tough in Dunedin, right? In New Zealand, you know, like businesses are finding it really tough. And so I was always lamenting, oh my gosh, I spent all my time and energy and resources to start a business that I think society needs right now. But when people are not coming in, I get really, well, I wouldn't say angry, but I was like, oh my gosh, you know, universe, you know, why are you not helping me, kind of thing.
Mm.
So yeah, right, the mindset was all wrong. So I should really be expecting nothing back.
Mm.
So that just really landed with me, and I only realized that about 2 to 3 weeks ago. So I'm starting to try and change my mindset. And it'll be interesting to see where I get to. Changing mindset is not easy because we all have these patterns in us, the way we respond, the way we think, the way we treat other people. They're all patterning and conditioning.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm working very hard at personal growth as well.
I love how the service, the values of service has been embedded in you from childhood. And on the show, we do travel back with our guests to learn more about how they grow up and also what life was like back then. Can you tell me a bit more about your family?
Yeah, sure. So I'm one in four. So I've got two brothers and one sister.
Are you the eldest?
I'm the eldest daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in those days, my parents felt that we'll be better off going to school in Singapore. So when I was 7 and a half, my brother was 8 and a half, we both of us were sent to school in Singapore, and we lived with my mum's auntie in a one-bedroom flat in Singapore because she was a widow. And yeah, and I think that was quite a formative period of my life. Having come from privilege, going into a one-bedroom flat, sleeping on the floor.
For education.
Yeah, and I think that has really grounded me, even though I'm, again, quite privileged in all areas of my life. I have always valued simple things. And I've always valued what is important. Yeah.
What do you remember about making that choice then and accepting that, you know, this is the life now in Singapore with your auntie?
Well, to be honest, I didn't have a choice, right? It's 7.5 and we just went with the flow. And so we lived with that auntie till I was about 12 or 13, and we moved multiple times with her through to different places. We lived with one of her daughters, and then we lived with someone else. And then eventually I went to live with my mum's sister. So by that time, my younger sister, she's about 1.5 years younger than me, had joined us as well. So there was three of us, and we were always moving. So we've always looked after one another. Well, possibly me and my sister. My older brother is a different kettle of fish. I think when being a boy, you know, he was trying to figure out his own stuff as well. So I remember buying my first bra myself. And I remember taking my sister to the neighborhood store and help her buy her first bra as well.
You had to figure that out yourself.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, my parents provided a lot for us. We were comfortable. You know, we were never hungry. We were never short of money. But a lot of things we had to figure out. And we were able to go back to Malaysia, I think it's at least 2 to 3 times a year. You know, always back home for Chinese New Year, always back home for the long holiday breaks. Yeah, so super interesting childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has really, really shaped who I have become. And that has really shaped why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And at that time, as a child, your goal was to be a flight attendant. That was your mindset, or did you have
other
interests?
I actually did quite well at school, and I think being the oldest daughter, I was a people pleaser. And because I can, and because I loved books and learning, so I did quite well at school, whereas my sister, not as much. She was very athletic. So we were kind of polar opposites.
Mm-hmm.
No, at the back of my mind, I've always wanted to be a flight attendant, but I know that that's not my life goal, I guess. So when I was around 16, we had just finished my O-levels. My parents said to me, right, you have two options. You can either go to England to go to boarding school, or you could go to, they said America or Australia, I can't remember. And I was like, yeah, boarding school sounds cool, you know, because I've been reading lots of books. Do you remember those Enid Blyton books about boarding schools, or Nancy Drew? And because I had read a lot when I was a kid, I wanted to go to boarding school. So when I was 16, went on a long flight, I remember, from Singapore to Manchester. Yep.
So you chose the UK.
Yeah.
Out of the other countries, because? Yeah,
because of the books that I read, right? It's like the Nancy, I don't know, is Nancy Drew British? I think it is, right? Or Enid Blyton. You hear of all the stuff that they will get up to. And I've always been like, yeah, I want to live in a tower. And I don't know.
Yeah. Just expectations versus reality as well. Yeah.
So when we landed, it was January, because school terms start quite differently there. And I remember the first night, it was cold, and then the next morning I looked out the window and I could see frost on the ground, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's snow, because I really thought it was snow, but it wasn't. And then I was so baffled when the milk delivery was, you know, at the front door. And yeah, I always remember eating cornflakes with those freshly squeezed milk. That's in my head, that's what I was thinking.
It's really beautiful when, you know, this is your life now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was 16. I just turned 16. I didn't know any better. I did not know any better.
What was it like making friends at that age? Because I can't imagine going to boarding school overseas,
you know? It was tough. So when we got there, we had stayed with my dad's friend's son or someone like that. And then we took a train. So that's me and my brother, took a train to the boarding school. And I remember when we got there, obviously it was cold and it was new to me. But the school was also, they started offering boarding for girls. So we were the first year. So girls are like a real commodity, a real, I don't want to say commodity, that sounds horrible. novelty. Girls are like, oh my gosh, it's such a novelty to have girls in the school because it was predominantly a boys' school. And then I was the first Chinese girl who boarded at that school.
Wow.
So there was no other Chinese girl at that school. There were some, I think, two or three other Chinese boys, and my brother was one of them, obviously. So people possibly looked at me with fascination. They used to think that my long black hair was like the most amazing thing they've ever seen. I was like, what the? Possibly because it was straight ass, right? It was difficult to make friends. I remember another girl called Lisa who started at the same time as me. So we were lucky and we had one another. So, yeah, she latched on to me. I latched on to her. And, yeah, and because she was this beautiful blonde girl, my status was instantly elevated because I hung out with a beautiful new girl. And possibly that was because, and possibly that's why my path was a lot more smooth at this school. But don't get me wrong, I still got bullied. But hey, that's a part of growing up.
And you were 16, I think.
I was 16.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that happened in the past that we just now realize that that's just what happens when you're 16, yeah. Unfortunately, you know?
I call it character building at boarding school because you had to fend for yourself. I can't remember if I felt angry or sad or whatever. I don't think I felt any of those emotions. I was just trying to survive. It wasn't bad, you know? It was all quite fresh and it was such a novelty. And the people that went to that school were all posh people. They all have posh parents. And so I got to see another part of the English society, I guess. And I remember when I finished at that boarding school 2.5 years later, there was a ball. And Prince Edward went to that ball.
Wow.
He was flown in a helicopter. And then, yeah, I was in like 2 meters, you know, I was 2 meters away from him. Yeah.
It feels like a really different part of society, just thinking
exactly.
About it now. Yeah.
Exactly. And I remember going on a train to go to Manchester to go to a hair salon and a makeup salon and got all done up. And then I had to hire a dress. I remember it was purple. Really regretting not taking any photos because I have absolutely no photos of what I look like. But yeah, that I felt like Cinderella because that was the first time ever that I got dressed up to go to a ball. How cool is that?
And to me, like I only see that in movies. Or, Bridgerton.
Exactly. It felt like that. And that was more than 35 years ago. Yeah. So that kind of put into perspective my life journey. Yeah.
I'm interested to know, you know, being Chinese in a school where it's predominantly English people, did you feel like you're physically different, but like the things that you value and the things that is important to you, your traditions, did they align with the community?
Good question. Such a good question. Did it align? I guess from a Chinese background and upbringing, alcohol was bad, right? My parents have always, well, I don't know, they don't drink alcohol, so alcohol to me was very foreign. Whereas alcohol was everywhere around me. So I remember my English friend, her name is Lisa, one night she said, hey, let's just go through the back gate and let's just walk around the seafront to go to the pub. I was like,
naughty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was like, what? But she said, oh, come on, it'll be fun. And so I went with her to go to the pub.
What was going inside you at that moment?
It was excitement, right? Yeah. It's what you read about in a book.
It's all for the books, yeah.
Yeah, it's what you read about in a book. So I remember getting into the pub and obviously she attracted a lot of attention. And then I was like, and she's like, come on, just try some, I don't know what I tried. And so she poured it into like a little cap. And that was my first taste of alcohol. And see, I still remember it. And that was in 1988, maybe. And that's possibly before most of the listeners were born. Yeah. So when we went back, the head girl had said to me, oh, I heard that you were at the pub. And yeah, so the boarding house mistress knew that some people had gone to the pub.
Did you get in trouble?
Well, they didn't think that I went because I was this goody-goody two-shoe.
You've surprised them.
I did. Yeah. But she said to me, I remember her name was Catherine, said to me, I will let you off this time, but just make sure you don't do it again.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
So she didn't drop me in.
I love how this is a core memory for you.
It is a core memory. And I remember seeing my brother a few days down the track, and I told him that I went to the pub. And then he went and told my parents.
How dare he?
So then they were quite worried, but I was like, nah. So, I mean, I never got drunk. And that was my first taste of alcohol. And because of the boarding school, you're not allowed to have access to alcohol, right?
Mm.
So, yeah, that was my first taste of alcohol. So did it align with my values? I don't know what my values were then. It wasn't aligned with my Chinese upbringing because alcohol was bad. So, yeah. See what I mean? I remember
that. But you do
need
to fit in with your friends at that time. Yeah.
And it was a venture. I was young. I was in a foreign environment. I had to fit in. You're right. But yeah, it's good. Yeah. I think it's great once in a while to go against your beliefs because they say that life happens outside your comfort zone.
And you wouldn't know unless you try.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. But luckily I didn't get caught. Yeah, so yeah, that was, yeah, fond memories.
I feel like this should be a book on itself.
Well, but I think there's a lot of things that I don't remember either. And
because of the alcohol.
I only had one capful, okay? Yeah, and I did not get drunk. So that was interesting. Did I get bullied on the streets? Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
I remember catching the tram down to the town that is closest to the boarding school. And that, again, I remember vividly being teased, Ching Chong Chinaman, you know, mm-hmm. something like those things. And that was the first time that I've ever been racially profiled. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I remember vividly. But since then, I've never really encountered any more racism. And that was just some young, innocent children that, again, was trying to act cool or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you were at boarding school mm-hmm. for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
What were your plans after that?
Yeah. So when I finished boarding school, it was July. It was European summer. So Lisa and I took a train to the south of France, and we spent 3 weeks in a caravan park. It sounds real dodgy, right? But it's actually a place that you go to where instead of living in motel units, you actually live in a caravan. It's like this one big party central. Yeah, so that was my plan. So we did that for 3.5 weeks. I got really, really, really brown. Like, I honestly was so sunburned. again, there was a lot of alcohol and all that, but I don't remember indulging in any of that because I think by that stage I was quite clear that I don't want to be one of those women who are let loose. Yeah, and again, I think my Chinese values upbringing
so rooted, yeah.
really grounded me. Yeah. And then after that, my parents gave me an option. By that stage, I had gone around universities in England and had gone into gone in for interviews. So I got into the London School of Pharmacy. So it was very clear to me at that stage that I love business, having grown up in businesses, and I also love science. So I decided to do pharmacy because at the boarding school they had a careers office. So you could go in and you could read up about different perspectives of different universities. So pharmacy just really resonated with me. So I had gotten into the London School of Pharmacy. And then my parents said to me, right, we're immigrating to New Zealand. That was in 1989. And they said, well, you can either stay in London or you could come back, well, come to New Zealand. At that stage, university was free. It was under the Labour government, Helen Clark. It was free. So, of course, I was like, yeah, I'll come to New Zealand, another adventure. So that is how I came to New Zealand when my parents immigrated here in 1989.
So your whole family moved here?
Yep.
Do you know why they moved?
Oh,
why did they choose New Zealand at that time?
I think my dad has some friends who were already here. Yeah. So they had originally landed in Wellington first. Whereas when I came to New Zealand, I think stayed in the Wellington house for a few months before I came down to Dunedin for university. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And between all of the other universities, you chose Otago because of the School of Pharmacy.
Otago was the only pharmacy school.
Ah.
Yeah. Yep. And it looked good and it was free. I was like, well, why not? By then, I was nearly 20 years old. Is that right? Yeah. 1920. Yeah.
How different was it from the UK to New Zealand?
I guess when you're at boarding school, everything was very self-guided, right? I had no parents to tell me what to do. I had to be self-motivated. We have our little studies, like little offices that we occupy. And yeah, you just have to lead your own way. I remember going to lectures at 3 PM and it's pitch black. So your body clock is already slowing down. So it's very difficult to go to lectures, go to dinner, then go back to the your boarding house, and then you got to motivate yourself to study. Yeah, so I found that quite difficult sometimes.
Mm.
Yeah, and then especially when other people are coming to you for questions or coming to you for other fun-filled activities. So it could be quite distracting as well. Yeah.
What was it like living with your family again?
Well, I didn't because I came back down to university down here. So when I was in Wellington, I was only there for a few weeks or a few months and my siblings were there. I think only my mum was there. My dad was still back in Malaysia.
So you still had your independency.
Yeah, mm. yeah. And my younger sister and younger brother, they went to the local high school. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think by that stage, I was a highly adaptable human because I had to adapt very, very quickly to my living environment. Having moved around so much in Singapore, having to live with other people in Singapore and to live, on a mattress on the floor and then moving to boarding school, sometimes I had my own room. Sometimes I had to share with other people. So by that stage, I was very, very adaptable.
Mm.
Yeah. I was very flexible.
Mm. Yeah. And that must be a really good skill to have, just with everyday.
Well, I didn't know I had that skill, right? I didn't know.
Until because, there was a word for it.
Yeah, I didn't know because I was just busy surviving and busy figuring out the world as a teenager or as a young adult. So when I got to Otago, I went into Helensburgh House. There's no, that doesn't exist anymore. It used to be the Wakery Hospital grounds, and there used to be a hostel up there. So again, I had my own room. So then it all felt quite familiar again. It was like boarding school, meals were prepared for you, but this time, you know, we're all adults. And again, I met lots of kids from around the country. So again, there's no different to boarding school. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Did I feel racially profiled or whatever you call it? No, I didn't. There were other Chinese students, Chinese as in not from mainland China. I met quite a few from Malaysia, from Singapore. I felt at home, yeah, because there were Chinese grocery stores. And, of course, in Dunedin, you get quite a few local Chinese as well and a few Hong Kong Chinese. Nah, I felt at home.
Was food important to you?
Yes and no, because I had turned vegetarian when I was 16 at boarding school because at that time the mad cow's disease was rampant. So then that the fear of convulsing on the ground, I think I saw images of that. So I had become a vegetarian. But now I was never fussy with food as long as vegetables, I'll eat it. Yeah, now food was never important to me. Again, I think it's because I had to adapt, right?
Mm.
Yeah, I'm a very tolerant and flexible and highly adaptable person.
Tell me about your pharmacy studies.
So it was 3 years, 4 years. Loved it. It was real up my alley, right? I love biology. I love chemistry, physics, not so much. But I loved it. And because the first year we used to do intermediate, like you have to do pharmacy intermediate or medicine intermediate before you could get in. So I had good enough grades to get in. And yeah, so when I was going through pharmacy school, I met lots of people. And in my final year, we were given an opportunity to go abroad for our externship. So I chose to go to the States. I remember getting a student loan to do that because it was fun. Mm-hmm. Like straight away, you have money. It was amazing. Not so much nowadays. So yeah, went with two other students and we went to a place called Spokane, which is in the Washington state. So we had spent some time in a community pharmacy, which is absolutely, totally different in the States. We had spent some time in a hospital and we also spent some time traveling, like going to Seattle, stopping by in Hawaii. Yeah, so it was fun. Fun times.
Mm.
Yeah.
I love how those were the highlights of of your degree.
Well, I think when you're at uni, right, that's when you finally taste freedom. But for me, I've already tasted freedom, so it wasn't, you know, that much of a thing for me. Like I was never a party animal. I didn't really drink that much. Mm. In fact, I don't even remember drinking at all.
But yeah, it's a different type of experience and yep, it's exciting.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm really interested to know how you got from pharmacy to now well-being, you know?
Yeah, okay. So after I graduated, I had spent a year working, take a step back. When I was going through pharmacy school, because my parents by then had moved to Auckland, so I was working as a student in one of the Auckland pharmacies. So then my boss then had asked me to come back as an intern, which means I spent a whole year working and training under them. Yeah, so then I did my internship in Auckland. And then I had, and at that time, tourism was exploding. And then some of my colleagues, they were all becoming international flight attendants with Air New Zealand. That's how the seed got planted. So I qualified as a pharmacist. It took a year. And then I started applying to Air New Zealand. And because then language speaker was very important to Air New Zealand because they were trying to expand into Asia, and because I'm able to speak Mandarin and a little bit of Cantonese and understand some dialects, I was picked. So while I was qualified as a pharmacist, I pursued my international flying career. So
what a busy year.
Yeah, wow. It was fun. It was fun. So when I wasn't flying, I was locuming in the same pharmacy, because sometimes we will get a long stretch of not working, like for about a week or something. Yeah, but I knew that it was a short-term thing. I knew that it's just my, what I call the OE, my overseas experience. Yeah. So I only did that for about 15 months. And then by then, my then boyfriend, now husband, is moving back down to Dunedin. And then one of his family friends was selling his pharmacy. So at the age of 27 or 26, at the age of 26, I had just finished flying. I bought into my first pharmacy at the Gardens. It used to be called Alpha Pharmacy. Right now, for some of your listeners, if you do go to New World Gardens, is where the self-checkout is, where that's where all the trolleys are now placed. The pharmacy is now gone. I was there for about 4.5 years. I sold it to the guy who now owns the Antidote Group, and he combined it with another pharmacy. So that chapter closed for me. But a week before that chapter closed, I was robbed at knife point by a druggie. I was like, I must have jinxed it. I must have jinxed it, because I was like, oh, phew. I'm, you know, nearly selling my pharmacy. And, oh, my God, it's so good I haven't been robbed. Because at that stage, home bake was a big thing. People were buying pseudoephedrine to make, I don't know what they're making, codeine or something. They were making their own stuff. So, yeah, a week before I sold the pharmacy, this guy came in, and I remember eating a muffin at about 5:30, 5:50, came in and said, open the safe, give me all your money, give me all your drugs. I've got a knife up my sleeve kind of thing, even though I didn't see a knife. Yeah, so I gave it to him, because we were trained to keep yourself safe, give whatever that you want, they want to them. So I gave it to him. Yeah.
How are you feeling now?
I guess I wasn't that traumatized, because he never hurt me, and he was a lot shorter than me, and you could tell that he was so jittery. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was traumatized by that. Thank God for that. So then that was that, and then we went to Singapore for about 4 years. Because my husband was doing his fellowship in Singapore. So by then, we already have the older daughter. So she was about 2, I think, when we went. Then I worked at a university hospital in Singapore as a pharmacist for, I think, at least a year and a bit. So then I was exposed to a different type of pharmacy.
Mm.
Yeah.
How different was it being in Asia? In that space?
Very different. In New Zealand, most of the medications are paid for by the government, right? Whereas in Asia, in Singapore, it's not. You have to dip into your, I think they call it, is it CPF, something like that? It's their like retirement savings. So then you get people picking and choosing what they want. Yeah, I remember it's very chaotic, and I also remember lots of people had kidney diseases. There was a lot of diabetes in the community. There was a lot of dialysis in the community. Yeah. So then I had my second daughter in Singapore, and then we moved back to Dunedin because my husband got a job at the hospital down here. So at that stage, the pharmacy group that I used to work for in Auckland, Life Pharmacy, is opening a Life Pharmacy branch down here. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be that person to bring it to Dunedin. At that time, I didn't know my values was innovation. So, yep, I wanted to do it. So I went and did it. 15 years down the track, a lot had changed. A lot had happened. I grew that pharmacy from nothing to a few $1 million turnover. It was hard work, don't get me wrong. And, yeah, it took a lot of innovative ideas. I came up with a brow bar idea because I had seen it overseas. I executed it. I came up with a walk-in beauty concept, executed that. And then at that stage, I was getting quite, I don't want to say bored, right? I just wanted a challenge. So I decided to buy a beauty clinic and change it into a laser clinic because laser hair removal was huge in Australia. I'm like, yeah, I can bring this to Dunedin. So I started, I bought a beauty clinic and changed it to Groom. That was nearly 10 years ago.
Is it in the same location?
No, we have moved multiple times. So after I set up Groom, I kind of got bored again. And when an opportunity came up to buy into Unichem Centre City Pharmacy in the Centre City Mall, I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'm going to do it. So I bought into that in July 2019. We all know what happened after that, mm-hmm. right? So when COVID hit, I had to manage two big pharmacies in the middle of town in Dunedin. So that really shifted me. I really saw a lot of desperation in the public. People were just giving away, I call it their health agency. They just wanted the government to fix everything. They just wanted us to fix everything for them. They're just not self-responsible. And I think that just really shifted in me, like the fear that I saw and the panic when they couldn't get their COVID passport. Remember those days when you have to get COVID passports? You have to come to the pharmacies and we have to access the COVID register to see whether you've had your two jabs or whatever. So those people will be so anxious and all they know how to do is to take it out on other people. So my team members were anxious. They were scared. They were like, you know, really worried about how they're going to enforce people putting on their masks. And again, I felt the fear of my team members. So people, there was just anxiety everywhere.
Yeah, and your perspective is so interesting because you were working in a pharmacy at that time of a COVID pandemic.
Yeah. So wow. I had to manage the COVID response to two pharmacies. And obviously we had to shut the whole, everything shut down, right? Whereas pharmacies, we had to keep on going. We had to keep on going and I had to keep the team separated. They would all have our different bubbles. And it was very surreal because at that stage in Wall Street Mall, we were the only business that was allowed to open. And because the entry was through the escalator. Some of your listeners may remember the escalators going down into the pharmacy. So at any one time, we will have about three people working. Well, not really working. There was no customers. And we were quite scared of our safety because if we needed help, who's going to come and save us? So then I asked the more, our landlord to give us security guards. So they had security guards at guarding the doors. And then we used to have people walk down the stairs and they would be dressed in all black and they will just wear whatever mask they can find. And I remember a guy came in once with a welding mask and with a black something else underneath. And then he was wearing all black in a leather jacket. And you were like, oh my gosh, are we in a movie or something? Is that Darth Vader? Or I don't know, whatever you call them. And then we were scared, right? Because, well, what happens if they want all our drugs? Or what happens if they want all our money?
Yeah. Well,
so there was fear. There was a lot of fear.
Wow.
You can see why it really shifted me, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is the backstory of why you shifted to well-being.
Yeah. And then we had to make up the COVID jabs and you know, we had to make sure. Yeah, there's a whole lot of coordination that had to happen in the background. Yeah, and because I think I had to manage two of that COVID response, and at the same time, you know, family health challenges as well also forced me to pause. I had to put the health of my family members first. Mm. And my dad at that stage up in Auckland, obviously he's diabetic. Then he was admitted into Middlemore Hospital with a health problem. And again, I saw the health system. I had flown up. I had seen the health system really, really stretched. And that, again, shifted something in me.
So at what point did you change? Did you try, you know, this new thing?
So there was another health challenge for one of my close family members. So at that stage, I had said to head office, because I was in partnership with the corporate listeners, even though I have shares in it, I said to them, look, I really have to focus on my family now. So I really am unable to carry on looking after the businesses. So they were very graceful and let me step away from the day-to-day running. So then I had spare time. I had a lot of spare time in my hands. So that was when I was like, oh, okay, what am I going to do? Because my priority then were my children and my mother-in-law, my dad. And then coaching was getting very popular and online. And I was like, yeah, I could do that. So then I trained as a health coach then. And that allowed me, knowing what I know now, our brains have lots of different parts. So when you're learning, you actually trigger your prefrontal cortex, which is the manager, the CEO of your brain. So because I was using so much of that part of my brain, I didn't have a lot of time to activate my fear center, which is my amygdala. I could have dwelled in all my misery and dwelled in all my misfortune or whatever you want to call it, but I didn't. Everything was very geared towards learning. Yeah.
Mm.
And then I was like, I could really take this coaching to the next level.
What did you need to get there?
One of the coaching philosophies also is you're going to meet people where they're at. If people do not want to be helped, you're not going to get there. And I had known that society is definitely not there. Society is still going through COVID. Society is still really traumatized.
Surviving, in fact.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, everyone is just surviving. And then I knew I possibly went to what I know best. I know the service industry. I know the retail industry. So, and through my 15 years as a retail pharmacy owner, I was always very interested in wellness, always very interested in nutritional and how our environment affects us and how our lifestyle really affects us. So I just went where I know best, which is creating this space that is like, if you like, people's escape from reality. And I really don't know what drove me. I sometimes blurred out that part of my life. I can't recall really in a lot of detail how I came to a lot of decisions. I just did it. Yeah, I really don't know where that energy or that momentum came from.
You've definitely built a really beautiful community down here.
Thank you. And I think knowing what I know now, when we go through trauma, there is a period that you experience post-traumatic growth. And I think that was what I went through. I grew from my traumatic experience. And again, I really credit doing my health coaching training to help me to be able to think clearly in a way, to lead me towards well and being. Yeah, so hopefully that's given you a really broad idea on how everything came about.
Mm. And I just love how you remember all the timelines as well.
True.
Yeah, true. It says a lot about your brain and how you just compartmentalize the experiences.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with being a pharmacist, right? Because our jobs, our daily jobs include a lot of, you have to get things right.
Attention to detail.
You have to prescribe the right medication. You have to dispense the right medications. And being a business owner, I have to make sure that every single part of the pharmacies, both pharmacies, were running to guidelines. So I had to do everything right. Yeah, so that's possibly where the excellence part of me, the values came out as well, because I was in a profession where I always have to do things right.
Mm.
Yeah.
In the last 5 minutes, Lee, I wonder if you
Has it been? Oh my God.
It's impossible to share your whole life story in 56 minutes. But I wonder if you can share with us, what are your well-being practices now?
Wow. Mm-hmm. No one has ever asked me.
No way.
Okay. So what is really important to me is nutrition. And because I know that my genetic background has a lot of diabetes and with a lot of cardiovascular diseases as well, both my grandparents died of heart attacks, and actually 3 out of 4 of my grandparents. So I know that my genetics, it predisposes me to that. So I'm very, very mindful of my glucose control, very, very mindful of my insulin response. So whenever I eat, I really prioritize protein. And also being a vegetarian is a big part of what we have to do, is make sure we have enough protein. So then I aim for 90 grams of protein per day. Aim is the key word. And then I'm also very in tune with my body. It's like if I feel super tired after I eat, I'll be like, okay, what I ate did not serve me and make me super tired because my blood glucose level had really dropped. So that is number one, is how I really prioritize my insulin control.
And you have awareness level of how the food made you feel.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So safe to say that I have no diabetes. I don't have any pre-diabetes either. All my siblings are pre-diabetic, all of them. And again, being Southeast Asian or Chinese, where our genes predisposes us to more incidence of diabetes and cardiovascular. So I'm very mindful of that. Number two is movement. I'm not talking about hit 30 minutes a day. I'm talking about just moving my body for 30 minutes a day. It can be 20. I don't beat myself up. As long as you're consistent, 10 minutes is enough. Consistency. Very important to me. What else is there? Sleep, super important. Again, that's when all the repair mechanisms are in place. I have slowed down a lot now, and I'm super aware of what stress does to my body. I've had biological aging testing done, and I know that stress aged my body 5 years in advance. So I'm really mindful of stress, and I reframe my stress as good stress and bad stress. So I'm really super aware. And I also do a lot of things that bring me joy. Mm. I knit a lot, and that's a hobby that I picked up about 15 months ago. Because when you knit, it just brings you so much joy because you can see your creation, and I love coming up with all the different ideas.
Innovation.
And I also know that, again, I've had genetic testing done, and I know that I burn through adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine, and estrogen really quickly. So then I know that if I don't keep topping up my dopamine, I'm going to be not very motivated. Mm-hmm. So knitting is really good for increasing my dopamine levels, because you're constantly creating and you get rewarded by seeing how something has grown. Yeah, so I guess the key word is being aware. I'm also gotten a lot better at naming my feelings. Because if you can't name, you can't tame your thoughts. I have my own podcast and we talk a lot about emotions, because that is super important, because otherwise you're just stressing out. Every single cell of your body is listening to your thoughts, whether they're kind thoughts or bad thoughts.
I honestly think we can talk about well-being the whole day. But
music to my ears.
Yes, but thankfully you have a podcast with us on ORFM, so people can find well and being. How are you really?
Mm-hmm.
On Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and also on oar.org.nz. Thank you so much, Lee, for being here today. I learned so much about you.
Thank you. And thank you so much.
Thank you for just giving us your story, because I think it's so valuable for people to hear what drives you and the experiences that you've had. It just, adaptability is definitely like the highlight of this whole podcast.
Interesting.
In my point of view.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for saying those kind words. I receive it. Yeah.
We'll see you again next time.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on ORFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.